This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Hellbent by Greg Hurwitz, performed by Scott Brick. To Gary and Karen Messing, and Dara and Zach Brewer, you don't get to choose your family, but sometimes you luck out. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. John Steinbeck, East of Eden. Evan's scuffed knuckles, a fetching post-fight shade of eggplant, ledged the steering wheel. His nose was freshly broken, leaking a trickle of crimson. Nothing bad, more a shifting along old fault lines. He inspected his nose in the rear view, then reached up and snapped it back into place. The Cadillac's alignment pulled to the right, threatening to dump him into the rain-filled roadside ditch. The seat springs poked into the backs of his thighs, and the fabric, dotted with cigarette scorch marks, reeked of menthol. The dumb light housed a bare, burned-out bulb. The brake discs made a noise like an asphyxiating chicken, and the left rear brake light was out. He should have stolen a better car. Rain dumped down. That was Portland for you. Or if he was being precise, a country road outside Hillsboro. Big drops turned the roof into a tin drum. Water sluiced across the windshield, rooster-tailed from the tires. He slid it around a bend, passing a billboard. A moment later, smeared red and blue lights illuminated the caddy's rear window. A cop. The broken brake light. That was inconvenient. Especially on this car, since a bolo had likely been issued. The cop would be running the plate number now if he hadn't already. Evan blew out a breath, leaned harder into the gas pedal. Here came the sirens. The headlights grew larger. Evan could see the silhouette of the officer behind the wheel. So much like a shooting target, head and chest, all critical mass. Hillsboro prided itself on being one of the safest cities in the Pacific Northwest. Evan hoped to keep it that way. As he popped the brakes and jerked the wheel, the heap of a car rocked on its shocks, fanning onto an intersecting road. Two more cop cars swept in behind him from the opposite direction. Evan sighed. Three patrol cars lit up like Christmas, sirens screaming, spreading out across both lanes and closing in. That was when the thumping from the trunk grew more pronounced. 1. No version of being too careful. Evan moved swiftly through the door to his penthouse suite at the Castle Heights residential tower, his rum zone pressed to his ear. The phone, encased in hardened rubber and gorilla glass, was as durable as a hockey puck and essentially impossible to trace. Every incoming call to 1-855-2-NOWHERE traveled in digital form over the Internet through a labyrinth of encrypted virtual private network tunnels. After a round-the-world tour of software telephone switch destinations, it emerged through the receiver of the roam zone. Evan always answered the phone the same way. Do you need my help? This time, for the first time, the voice on the other end was a familiar one. Jack Johns. Jack had plucked Evan from the obscurity of a foster home at the age of 12 and placed him in a fully deniable black program buried deep inside the Department of Defense. Jack had turned Evan into Orphan X, an expendable assassin who went where the U.S. government would not and did what the U.S. government could not. Jack had fought for Evan to stay human, even while teaching him to be a killer. The only father Evan had ever known was calling this line now, a line reserved for those in mortal danger, and he had answered Evan's question, "Do you need my help?" with a single syllable. Yes. Evan and Jack had an elaborate series of protocols for establishing contact. Never like this. For Jack to call this number meant that he was up against what others might consider world-destroying trouble. All Evan had gotten over the phone so far was that one word. Static fuzzed the line infuriatingly, the connection going in and out. He was gripping the phone too hard. Jack. 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 8 years ago, Evan had gone rogue from the orphan program. At the time, he'd been the program's top asset. Given the sensitive information in his head, the bodies he'd put in the ground, and the skills encoded into his muscles, he could not be allowed to exist. The most merciless of the orphans, Charles Van Sciver, had taken over the program and was hell-bent on tracking down and eradicating Evan. Vanishing was easier when you already didn't exist. The orphan program lived behind so many veils of secrecy that no one, except their immediate handlers, knew who the orphans were. They were kept in separate silos and deployed through encoded comms that preserved plausible deniability at every level. Double-blind protocols ensured that even the handlers' whereabouts were often unknown by higher headquarters. And so Evan had simply stepped off the grid, keeping only the operational alias he'd earned in the Shadow Service, a name spoken in hushed tones in the back rooms of intel agencies the world over. The Nowhere Man. He now helped the desperate, those with no place left to turn, people suffering at the hands of unrepentant and vicious abusers. His clients called 1-855-2-NOWHERE, and their problems were solved. Antiseptic. Effective. Impersonal. Until this. Evan's tense steps echoed around the 7,000 square feet of his condo. The open stretch of gunmetal gray floor was broken by workout stations, a few sitting areas, and a spiral staircase that rose to a loft he used as a reading room. The kitchen area was equally modern, all stainless steel and poured concrete. The views up here on the 21st floor were dazzling, downtown Los Angeles shimmering like a mirage 12 miles to the east. Despite all that space, Evan was having trouble breathing. He felt something wild clawing in his chest, something he couldn't identify. Fear? Jack! The reception crackled some more, and then, finally, Jack's voice came through again. Evan? It sounded as if Jack was in his truck, an engine humming in the background. I'm here, Evan said. Are you okay? Through the receiver, he could make out more road rolling beneath Jack's tires. When Jack spoke again, his voice sounded broken. Do you regret it? What I did to you? Evan inhaled, steadied his heart rate. What are you talking about? Do you ever wish I'd never taken you out of that boy's home? That I'd just let you live an ordinary life? Jack, where are you? I can't tell you. Dollars to donuts, they've got ears on me right now. Evan stared out through the floor-to-ceiling, bullet-resistant Lexan windows. The discreet armor sunshades were down, but through the gaps in the woven titanium chain-link, he could still see the city sparkling. There was no version of being too careful. Then why are you calling? Evan said. I wanted to hear your voice. Over the line, tires screeched. Jack was driving fast. This much Evan could glean. But he couldn't know that Jack was being pursued. Surreptitiously, yet not so surreptitiously that Jack didn't notice, by 5 SUVs in rolling surveillance. Or that a Stingray cell tower simulator was intercepting Jack's signal, capturing his every word. That within 5 minutes, the thwap, thwap, thwap of rotor blades would stir the clouds, and a Black Hawk attack helicopter would break through the night sky and plummet down, fanning up dust. That thermal imaging had already pegged Jack in his driver's seat, his 98.6-degree body temperature rendered in soothing reds and yellows. All Evan knew right now was that something was terribly wrong. The static rose like a growl, and then abruptly, the line was as clear as could be. This is looking to be my 9th life, son. For a moment, Evan couldn't find his voice, Then he forced out the words. Tell me where you are, and I'll come get you. It's too late for me, Jack said. If you won't let me help you, then what are we supposed to talk about? I suppose the stuff that really matters. Life. You and me. Jack, breaking his own rules. Because we're so good at that? Jack laughed that gruff laugh, a single note. Well, sometimes we miss what's important for the fog. But maybe we should give it a go before, you know. More screeching of tires. Better make it snappy, though. Evan sensed an inexplicable wetness in his eyes and blinked it away. Okay, we can try. Do you regret it? Jack asked again. What I did. How can I answer that? Evan said. This is all I know. I never had some other life where I was a plumber or a school teacher or a dad. Now the sound of a helo came through the line, barely audible. Jack, you still there? I guess I want to know that I'm forgiven. Evan forced to swallow down his dry throat. If it wasn't for you, I would have wound up in prison, dead of an overdose, knifed in a bar. Those are the odds. I wouldn't have had a life. I wouldn't have been me. He swallowed again, with less success. I wouldn't trade knowing you for anything. A long silence, broken only by the thrum of tires over asphalt. Finally, Jack said, It's nice of you to say so. I don't put much stock in nice. I said it because it's true. The sound of rotors intensified. In the background, Evan heard other vehicles squealing. He was listening with every ounce of focus he had in him. A connection routed through 15 countries in 4 continents, a last tenuous lifeline to the person he cared about more than anyone in the world.
We didn't have time, Evan said. We didn't have enough time.
Jack said, I love you, son. Evan had never heard the words spoken to him. Something slid down his cheek, clung to his jawline. He said, Copy that. The line went dead. Evan stood in his condo, the cool of the floor rising through his boots, chilling his feet, his calves, his body. The phone was still shoved against his cheek. Despite the full body chill, he was burning up. He finally lowered the phone, peeled off his sweaty shirt. He walked over to the kitchen area and tugged open the freezer drawer. Inside, lined up like bullets, were bottles of the world's finest vodkas. He removed a rectangular bottle of Double Cross, a 7 times distilled and filtered Slovak spirit. It was made with winter wheat and mountain spring water, pulled from aquifers deep beneath the Tatra Mountains. It was one of the purest liquids he knew. He poured 2 fingers into a glass and sat with his back to the cold sub-zero. He didn't want to drink, just wanted it in his hand. He breathed the clean fumes, hoping that they would sterilize his lungs, his chest, his heart. Well, he said, fuck. Glass in hand, he waited there for 10 minutes, and then 10 more. His roam zone rang again. Caller ID didn't show unidentified caller or blocked caller. It showed nothing at all. With dread, Evan clicked the phone on, raised it to his face. It was the voice he'd most feared. Why don't you go fetch your digital contact lenses, it said. You're gonna want to see this. 5 days earlier. 2. Dark matter. The burly man forged through fronds and the paste of the jungle humidity, his feet sinking into Amazonian mud. A camouflaged boonie hat shadowed his face. A cone of mosquito netting descended from the hat's brim, breathing in and out with him. The ghostly effect, that of an amorphously shaped head respiring, made him seem like a bipedal monster flitting among the rotting trunks. Sweat soaked his clothes. On his watch, a red GPS dot blinked, urging him forward. Behind him, another man followed. Jordan Thornhill was gymnast compact, all knotty muscle and precision, his hair shaved nearly to the skull, a side part notched in with a razor. He'd taken off his shirt and tucked it into the waistband of his pants. Perspiration oiled his dark skin. They'd left the rented jeep a few miles back, where dense foliage had finally smothered the trail. They kept on now in silence, mud sucking at their boots, leaves rustling across their broad shoulders. Strangler vines wrapped massive trees, choking the life from them. Bats flitted in the canopy. Somewhere in the distance, howler monkeys earned their names. Thornhill kept tight to the big man's back, his movement nimble, fluid. "We're a long way from Kansas, boss. You even sure this dude has it on him?" The invisible face beneath the boonie hat swiveled to Thornhill. The netting beat in and out like a heart. Then the man lifted the netting, swept it back over the brim. Surgeries had repaired most of the damage on the right side of Charles Van Sciver's face, but there remained a few feathers of scarring at the temple. The pupil of his right eye was permanently dilated, a tiny starfish-shaped cloud floating in its depths. Souvenirs from an explosive that had been sent by Orphan X nearly a year ago. As the director of the orphan program, Van Sciver had the resources to eradicate most of the physical damage, but rage endured just beneath the skin, undiminished. Thornhill grew uneasy under Van Sciver's gaze. That shark eye. It had an unsettling effect on people. "It was on his person," Van Sciver said. "I have it on good authority." "Whose authority?" "Are you actually asking me?" Van Sciver said. The scars didn't look so bad until he scowled and the skin pulled taut, stretching the wrong way. Thornhill shook his head. "The real question is it still there?" Van Sciver said. "For all we know, it could be riding in the belly of a jaguar already. Or if there was a fire, who the hell knows?" "Sometimes," Thornhill said, "all a man needs is a little luck." Yes, luck. For months, Van Sciver had lived inside a virtual bunker built of servers, applying the most powerful deep learning data mining software in computational history to finding some, any trace of Orphan X. The recent directives from above had been clear. Van Sciver's top priority was to stamp out wayward orphans. Anyone who'd retired, anyone who hadn't made the cut, anyone who had tested questionable for compliance, and most important, the only orphan who had ever, in the storied history of the program, gone rogue. The program's large-scale data processing had at last spit out a lead, a glimmer of a fishing lure in the ocean of data that surged through cyberspace on a daily basis. Even calling it a lead, Van Sciver thought now, was too ambitious. More like a lead that could lead to a lead, that could lead to Orphan X. The story behind it had quickly become legend in the intel community. It went like this. A mid-level DOD agent had once, through a labyrinthine process of extortion and blackmail, acquired a copy of highly sensitive data pertaining to the orphan program. A few aliases, a few last known addresses, a few pairings of handlers and orphans. These key bits and pieces had been captured from various classified channels outside the orphan program in the seconds before they auto-redacted. The agent had hoped it would hasten his rise inside the department, but quickly learned that he'd caught a hot grenade. The data was too dangerous to use. He'd kept it as an insurance policy, despite standing orders to the contrary that originated from Pennsylvania Avenue, that any and all data pertaining to the orphan program must be expunged. Rumors of this shadow file persisted over the past months, but had remained only rumors. until the powerful data mining engines at Van Sciver's disposal had caught the scent of this shadow file and verified its existence by shading in bits of surrounding intelligence, like gleaning the existence of invisible dark matter by observing gravity effects around it. The mid-level agent had sensed the crosshairs at his back and had gone to ground, in more ways than one. In the end, it hadn't been an orphan or a fellow agent who had brought him down, but an unexpected trade wind. Van Sciver had promised himself that when the time came, he'd leave his bunker and get his boots muddy for a lead that might bring him to Orphan X. So, here he was, squelching through the boggy muck of another continent, reaching for that shiny lure. They smelled it before they saw it, a slaughterhouse stench lacing the thick, heavy-hanging air. They crested a slope. Up ahead, the snapped-off tail rotor of a Sikorsky S-70 was embedded in the trunk of a banyan, cleaving the massive tree nearly in half. Thornhill waved a hand in front of his face. God damn! Van Sciver drew in a lungful of aviation fuel and rotting flesh, a reek so strong he could taste it. They shouldered through a tangle of underbrush. And there it was. The downed fuselage rested on its side, nudged up against an enormous boulder like a dog trying to scratch its back. A tired 70s Army transport chopper repurposed for private charters, sold and resold a dozen times over, now being slowly devoured by the jungle. The pilot had been thrown through the windshield. His body, held together by the flight suit, was cradled tenderly upside down in the embrace of a strangler vine, 20 feet off the ground. His flesh seemed to be alive, crawling with movement. Fire ants. A rustling came from the fuselage, and then a desiccated voice.
Is someone there? God, please, say someone's there.
Van Sciver and Thornhill drew close. Van Sciver had to crouch to see inside. The NSA agent hung lifeless from the sideways seat, his arms dangling awkwardly, a roller coaster rider in the twist of a corkscrew. The shoulder harness bit into the charcoal suit jacket and, given the heat, seemed to be making some headway through the underlying flesh as well. The agent's fellow passenger had managed to pop his own seatbelt. He'd landed with his legs bent all wrong. A shiv of bone jutted up through his pants at the shin. The skin around it was puffy and red. Tears glistened on his cheeks.
I thought I was gonna die here. I've been alone with... in the middle of...
His sobs deteriorated into dry heaves. Van Sciver looked past him at the dead agent and felt a spark of hope flare inside his chest. The body looked reasonably well-preserved hanging there. Van Sciver forced his excitement back into the tiny dark space in his chest that he reserved for Orphan X. He'd been close so many times, only to have his fingertips slip off the ledge. The harness kept him off the ground, Van Sciver said to Thornhill, away from the elements. We might have a shot. The passenger reached toward Van Sciver.
Water, he said. I need water.
Thornhill darted inside, hopping gracefully through the wreckage until he stood beneath the agent, practically eye to eye. He's fairly intact, Thornhill said. Not gonna place at the Miss America pageant, but still. We got us a good-looking corpse. The passenger gave with a dry, hacking cough.
Water,
he whispered. Let's get the body out, Van Sciver said. I'll unclip the harness, Thornhill said, and you ease him down. The last thing we need is his festering ass disintegrating all over the fuselage.
Please.
The passenger clutched the cuff of Van Sciver's pants.
Please, at least look at me.
Van Sciver removed the pistol from his underarm tension holster and shot the passenger through the head. Taking hold of the passenger's loafers, he dragged the man clear of the fuselage. Then he returned to the downed helo, and he and Thornhill gently guided the agent down. It involved some unpleasant grappling. The stench was terrible, but Van Sciver was accustomed to terrible things. They carried the corpse gingerly out into the midday blaze and laid it on a flat stretch of ground. Thornhill's eyes were red. Choking noises escaped his throat. They took a break, walking off a few paces to find fresh air. When they got back to civilization, Van Sciver realized their clothes would have to be burned. By unspoken accord, they reconvened over the body. They stared down at it. Then Van Sciver flicked out a folding knife and cut the clothes off. The bloated body lay there, emitting gases. Thornhill was ordinary-looking by design, as were most of the orphans, chosen so they could blend in. But his smile was unreasonably handsome. He flashed it now. This shit right here? We are living the dream. Van Sciver reached into his cargo pocket, removed two sets of head-mounted watch repair binoculars, and handed one to Thornhill. Any idea where it would be? Thornhill asked. Fingernails, toenails, hair. They tied their shirts over their mouths and noses like bandidos, got down on all fours, and began their gruesome exploration. The first hour passed like a kidney stone. The second was even worse. By the third, winged insects clustered, clogging the air around them. Shadows stretched like living things. Soon it would be nightfall, and they could not afford to wait another day. Thornhill was working the agent's hair, picking through strand by strand. Finally, he sat back on his heels, gulped a few quick breaths, and spit a wad of cottony saliva to the side. Are we sure it's on him? Van Sciver paused, holding one of the agent's jaundiced hands delicately. It was goosenecked at the wrist, ready to receive a manicure. The skin shifted unsettlingly around the bone. Sweat trickled down into Van Sciver's eyes, and he armed it off. He could still see through his right eye, but after so much meticulous concentration, the blown pupil and bruised retina gave him trouble focusing. He could feel the muscles straining. He did his best to blink free the moisture. Then he froze, seized by a notion. Leaning forward, he parted the dead man's eye. Its pretty blue iris had already filmed over. He thumbed at an upper lid, splaying the lashes. Nothing. He checked the lower lid next. And there it was. A lash, hidden among others. It was glossier and more robust, with a touch of swelling at the insertion point. It was a hair, all right. Just not the agent's. With a pair of tweezers, Van Sciver plucked out the transplant and examined it more closely. The lash was synthetic. This was not the future of data storage. It was the original data storage. For billions of years, DNA has existed as an information repository. Instead of the ones and zeros that computers use to render digital information, DNA utilizes its four base codes to lay down data complex enough to compose all living matter. Not only had this staggeringly efficient mechanism remained stable for millennia, it required no power supply and was temperature resistant. Van Sciver had reviewed the research and its big claims that one day a teaspoon of synthetic DNA could contain the entirety of the world's data. But despite all the outlandish talk of exabytes and zettabytes, the tech remained nascent and the costs staggering. In fact, the price of encoding a single megabyte with digital information was just shy of 20 grand. But the information on this single eyelash was worth more than that. To Van Sciver, it was worth everything. It contained nothing directly related to Orphan X. Evan was too adept at covering his trail, but compared to the expansive data Van Sciver had been sifting through, it held a treasure trove of specifics. Holding the lash up against the orange globe of the descending sun, Van Sciver realized that he had forgotten to breathe. He also realized something else. For the first time he could recall, he was smiling. free everything he held dear. Venice was a beautiful city, but like many beauties, she was temperamental. Furious weather kept the tourists inside. Rain hammered the canals, wore at the ancient stone, bit the cheeks of the few brave enough to venture out. The storm washed the color from everything, turning the floating city into a medley of dull grays. Nearing the Ponte di Rialto, Jim Harville spotted the man tailing him. A black man in a raincoat, bent into the punishing wind a ways back. He was skilled. Were it not for the weather-thinned foot traffic, Harville never would have picked him up. It had been several years since he'd operated, and his skills were rusty. But habits like these were never entirely forgotten. Harville hiked up the broad stone steps of the bridge, the Grand Canal surging furiously below. He reached the portico at the top and cast a glance back. Across the distance, the men locked eyes. A gust of wind howled through the ancient mazework of alleys, ruffling the shop canopies, making Harville stagger. When he regained his footing and looked back up, the man was sprinting at him. It was a strange thing, so many years later, to witness aggression this naked. Instinct put a charge into Harville, and he ran. Vanishing up a tight street, he took a hairpin left between two abandoned palazzos and shot across a cobblestone square. He had no weapon. The man pursuing him was younger and fitter. Harville's only advantage was that he knew the city's complex topography, as well as he knew the contours of his wife's back, the olive skin he traced lovingly each night as she drifted off to sleep. He shouldered through a boutique door, overturned a display table of carnival masks, barged through a rear door into an alley. Already he felt a burning in his legs. Giovanna liked to joke that she kept him young for 50, but even so, retirement had left him soft. He careened out onto a calle at the water's edge. Across the canal a good distance north, his pursuer appeared, skidding out from between two buildings. The man saw him. He flung his arms back, and his jacket slid off gracefully, as if tugged by invisible strings. Rain matted his white T-shirt to his torso, his dark skin showing through, the grooved muscles visible even at this distance. The man's eyes dropped to the choppy water, and then he bounded across, froggering from pier to trash barge and onward, leaving two moored gondolas rocking in his wake. Dread struck Harville's stomach like a swallowed stone. He registered a single thought. Orphan. The man was on Harville's side of the canal now, but propitiously, a wide intersecting waterway provided a barrier between them. As Harville began his retreat, the man vaulted over an embankment, rolled across a boat prow, and sprang up the side of a building, finding hand and footholds on downspouts and window shutters. Even as he went vertical, his momentum barely slowed. That particular brand of obstacle course discipline, parkouring, had come into popularity after Harville's training, and he couldn't help but watch with a touch of awe now. The man hauled himself through a third-story window, scaring a chinless woman smoking a cigarette back onto her heels. An instant later, the man flew out of a neighboring window on Harville's side of the waterway. Harville had lost precious seconds. He reversed, splashing through a puddle, and bolted. The narrow passages and alleys unfolded endlessly, a match for the thoughts racing in his head. Giovanna's open-mouthed laugh, their freestanding bathtub on the cracked marble floor, bedside candles mapping yellow light onto the walls of their humble apartment. Without a conscious thought, he was running away from home, leading his pursuer farther from everything he held dear. He sensed footfalls quickening behind him. Columns flickered past, lending the rain a strobe effect as he raced along the arcade bordering Piazza San Marco. The piazza was flooded, the angry Adriatic surging up the drains, blanketing the stones with 2 feet of water. Quite a sight to see the great square empty. Harville was winded. He stumbled out into the piazza, sloshing through floodwater. St. Mark's Basilica tilted back and forth with each jarring step. The mighty clock tower rose to the north, the two bronze figures, one old, one young, standing their sentinel's watch on either side of the massive bell, waiting to memorialize the passing of another hour. Harville wouldn't make it across the square into the warren of alleys across. He was bracing himself to turn and face when the round punched through his shoulder blade and spit specks of lung through the exit wound as it cleared his chest. He went down onto his knees, his hands vanishing to the elbows in water. He stared dumbly at his fingers below, rippling like fish. The voice from behind him was as easygoing as a voice could be. "Orphan Jay, a pleasure." Harville coughed blood, crimson flecks riding the froth. "Jack Johns," the man said. "He was your handler, way back when."
"I don't know that name."
Harville was surprised that he could still form words. "Oh, you mistook me. That wasn't a question. We haven't gotten to the questions yet." The man's tone was conversational, good-natured even. Harville's arms trembled. He stared down at the eddies, the stone, his hands. He wasn't sure how much longer he could keep his face out of the water. At some point it had stopped raining. The air had a stunned stillness, holding its breath in case the storm decided to come back. The man asked, "What are your current protocols when you contact Jack Johns?" Harville wheezed with each breath.
"I don't know that name."
The man crouched beside him. In his hand was a creased photograph. It showed Adelina nestled in Giovanna's arms, feeding. She was still wearing her pink knit cap from the hospital. Harville felt air leaking through the hole in his chest. He told the man what he wanted to know. The man rose and stood behind him. The water stirred around Harville. He closed his eyes. He said,
"I had a dream that I was normal."
The man said, "And it cost you everything." The pistol's report lifted a flight of pigeons off the giant domes of the basilica. As the man pocketed his pistol and forged his way through the floodwater, the hour sounded. High on the clock tower, the two bronze forms, one old, one young, struck the bell they'd been ringing across these worn stones for 5 centuries and counting. Back to the present. 4. Are you ready? Evan was still sitting in the kitchen, the Sub-Zero numbing his bare back, the glass of vodka resting on his knee. The phone remained at his face. He felt not so much paralyzed as unwilling to move. Movement would prove that time was passing, and right now time passing meant that bad things would happen. He reminded himself to breathe. 2-second inhale, 4-second exhale. He reached for the 4th commandment. Never make it personal. Jack had taught him the commandments and would want, no, demand that Evan honor them now. The 4th wasn't working, so he dug for the 5th. If you don't know what to do, do nothing. There was no situation that could not be made worse. The vodka glass perspired in Evan's hand. The phone connection was as silent as the grave. Van Sciver said, "Did you hear me?" Evan said, "No." He wanted more time. Though for what? He wasn't sure. "I said, go fetch your digital contact lenses. I have something you want to see." 2-second inhale, 4-second exhale. "Let me be perfectly clear," Evan said. "If you do this, nothing will ever stop me from getting to you." "But X," Van Sciver said pleasantly, "you don't even know what I have planned." The line cut out. 2-second inhale, 4-second exhale. Evan rose. He set the glass down on the poured concrete island. He walked out of the kitchen and past the living wall, a vertical garden of herbs and vegetables. The rise of greenery gave the penthouse its sole splash of color and life, the air fragranced with chamomile and mint. He headed across the open plain of the condo, past the heavy bag and the pull-up bar, past the freestanding central fireplace, past a cluster of couches he couldn't remember ever having sat on. He walked down a brief hall with two empty brackets where a katana sword had once hung. He entered his bedroom with its floating maglev bed, propelled 2 feet off the floor by ridiculously powerful rare-earth magnets. Only cable tethers kept it from flying up and smashing into the ceiling. Like Evan, it was designed for maximum functionality. Slab, mattress, no legs, no headboard, no footboard. He entered his bathroom, nudged the frosted glass shower door aside on its tracks. It rolled soundlessly. Stepping into the shower, he curled his hand around the hot water lever. Hidden sensors in the metal read his palm imprint. He turned it the wrong way, pushing through with slight resistance, and a hidden door broke free from the tile pattern of the stall and swung inward. Evan stepped into the vault, the nerve center of his operations as the Nowhere Man. 400 square feet of exposed beams and rough concrete walls, crowded from above by the underbelly of the public stairs leading to the roof. An armory and a workbench occupied one side. A central sheet metal desk shaped like an L held an impeccably ordered array of computer towers, servers, and antennae. Monitors filled an entire wall, showing various hacked security feeds of Castle Heights. From here, Evan could also access the majority of law enforcement databases without leaving a footprint. The door to the massive gun safe hung ajar. Beneath a row of untraceable, aluminum-forged, custom-machined Ares 1911 pistols, a slender silver case the size of a checkbook rested on a shelf. Evan opened it. 10 radio-frequency identification-tagged fingernails and a high-def contact lens waited inside. The device, which Evan had taken from the dead body of one of Van Sciver's orphans, served as a double-blind means of communication between Evan and his nemesis. Evan applied the nails to his fingertips and inserted the lens. A virtual cursor floated several feet from his head. He moved his fingers in the space before him, typing in thin air, "Here." A moment later, Van Sciver's reply appeared. "Excellent. Are you ready?" Evan took a deep breath, wanting to hold on to these last precious seconds before his world flew apart. He typed, "Yes." Jack finally decided enough was enough and pulled his truck over onto a broad dirt fire road that split an endless field of cotton. Dust from the tires ghosted its way down the deserted strip of road. He couldn't see the chopper in the darkness, but he heard it circling high overhead. He threw the truck into park, kept his eyes pegged on the rear view, and waited, his breath fogging in the winter chill. Sure enough, SUV headlights appeared. Then another set. The vehicles parked 10 yards off his rear bumper. 3 more black SUVs came at him from the front. He watched them grow larger in the windshield until they slant-parked, hemming him in. He traced his fingers absently on the driver's window, drawing patterns, shot a breath at the dashboard. Then, groaning, he climbed out. The men piled out of the vehicles in full battle rattle, M4 carbines raised. A few of the men held AK-47s instead. "Both hands! Let's see 'em!" "Okay, okay." Jack wearily patted the air in their direction, showing his palms. He was still pretty goddamned fit for a man in his 70s, but he'd noticed that his baseball catcher build had started to soften over the past few months, no matter how many push-ups and sit-ups he did each morning. The years caught up to everyone. He breathed in fresh soil and night air. The cotton stretched out forever, dots of white patterned against brown stems, like snow melting on a rocky hillside. It was Thanksgiving Day. The harvest looked to be running late. He watched the men approach, how they held their weapons, where their eyes darted. They moved well enough. But 2 of them had their left thumbs pointing up on the magazine well grips rather than aligned with the AK barrels. If they were forced to switch shooting sides, the charging handles would smash their thumbs when they cycled. Freelancers. Not orphans. Definitely not orphans. But there were 15 of them. A few grabbed Jack, patted him down roughly, and zip-tied his hands behind his back. One man stepped forward. His shaved head gleamed in the headlight's glow. The plates of his skull ridged his shiny scalp. It was not a pretty head. It could have used a bit of cover. He raised a radio to his lips. Target secured. The others shifted in place, boots creaking. Relax, boys, Jack said. You did good. The guy lowered the radio. You're finished, old man. Jack pursed his lips, took this in with a vague nod. He'll come for you. He cast his eyes across the freelancers. With all the fury in the world. The men blinked uncomfortably. The door of the closest SUV opened, and another man stepped into view. Compact and muscular. He threw his sculpted arms wide, as if greeting a long-lost relative. You're a hard man to track down, Jack Johns, he said. Jack took his measure. Jordan Thornhill. Orphan R. Surprise flickered across Thornhill's face. You know me? Of you, anyway, Jack observed. When you live as long as I have, son, you have eyes and ears in a lot of places. You're fortunate, Thornhill said, to have lived so long. Yeah, Jack said. I was. The whooping grew louder. A Black Hawk banked into view over the hillside and sent down before them. Dirt and twigs beat at them. Jack closed his eyes against the rotor wash. As the rotors spun down, a pair of geared-up men emerged. They wore flight suits and parachutes and looked generally overprepared. Three more men and the pilot waited inside the chopper. Jack shouted, "A bit of overkill, don't you think?" Thornhill shouted, "We owe a debt of gratitude to helicopters this week." Jack didn't know what to make of that. "Well," he said, "let's get on with it then." The two men in flight suits took Jack by either arm and conveyed him over to the helo. The others hauled him in. As they lifted off, Jack caught a bird's-eye view of Thornhill vanishing back into the SUV as smoothly as he'd appeared. Two freelancers headed to search Jack's truck, and the others peeled off to their respective vehicles and drove away. The helo rose steeply and kept rising. Blackhawks have an aggressive rate of climb, and the pilot seemed intent on showing it off. This wasn't going to be a joyride. No. This trip had another purpose entirely. Jack had done more jumps than he could count, so he knew how to roughly gauge altitude by the lights receding below. They passed 10,000 feet. 15. Somewhere north of that, they stopped and hovered. One of the men donned a bulky headset and readied a handheld digital video camera. Another slid open the doors on either side. Wind ripped through the cabin, making Jack stagger. Given his cuffed wrists, he couldn't use his arms for balance, so he took a wide stance. The cameraman shouted, "Look into the camera!" Jack did as told. The cameraman listened to someone over his headset and then said, "What are your current protocols for contacting Orphan X?" Jack shuffled closer, the wind blasting his hair, and squinted into the lens. "Van Sciver, you can't honestly believe this will work on me." The cameraman listened again and then repeated his question. Jack's shoulders ached from his hands being cinched behind his back, but he knew he wouldn't have to bear the pain much longer. "There is nothing you could ever do to make me give up that boy," Jack said. "He's the best part of me." The cameraman winced, clearly catching an earful from Van Sciver over the headset, then squared to Jack with renewed focus. "I'd suggest you reconsider. We're at 16,000 feet, and you're the only one up here without a parachute on." Jack smiled. "And you're dumb enough to think that puts you at an advantage." He bulled forward, grabbed the cameraman's ripcord handle between his teeth, and flung his head back. There was a moment of perfect, stunned silence as the parachute hit the cabin floor. The wind lifted the nylon gently at first, like a caress. And then the canopy exploded open, knocking over the men in the cabin. The cameraman was sucked sideways out the open door. The Black Hawk lurched violently, as first the chute and then the cameraman gummed into the tail rotor. The Black Hawk wheeled into a violent 360. Jack gave a parting nod to the sprawled men and stepped off into the open air. On his way out, he saw the powerful ripstop nylon wrapping around the bent metal blades. By instinct, Jack snapped into an approximation of the skydiver's stable position, flattening out, hips low, legs spread and slightly bent. His hands were cuffed, but he pulled his shoulders back, broadening his chest, keeping his hanging point above his center of gravity. The wind riffled his hair. He watched the sparse house lights wobble below, like trembling candles holding strong in a wind. He figured he'd have hit 125 miles per hour by now. Terminal velocity for a human in free fall. He'd always loved flying. Jack thought of the malnourished 12-year-old kid who'd climbed into his car all those years ago, blood crusted on the side of his neck. He thought about their silent hikes through the dappled light of an oak forest outside a Virginia farmhouse, how the boy would lag a few paces so he could walk in the footprints Jack left shoved into the earth. He thought about the way his stomach had roiled when he'd driven that boy, then 19 years old, to the airport for his first mission. Jack had been more scared than Evan was. "I will always be there," Jack had told him. The voice on the other end of the phone. The ground was coming up fast. "I will always be there." Jack shifted his legs and flipped over, now staring up at the night sky, letting gravity take his tired bones. The stars were robust tonight, impossibly sharp, the moon crisp enough that the craters stood out like smudges from a little boy's hand. Against that glorious canopy, the Black Hawk spun and spun. He saw it disintegrate. A final satisfaction before he hit the ground. Evan stood in the darkness of the vault, breathing the dank air, watching the live feed with horror. The dizzying POV of the camera flying haphazardly around the cabin, banging off tether straps, jump seats, screaming men, and then airborne, free of the cabin, spinning off into the black void. The only sound now was the violence of the wind. Evan's brain was still stuck 30 seconds back when Jack had walked out the cabin door, as calmly as if he were stepping off a diving board. The virtual ground came up and hit Evan in the face. Static. Evan's last panicked text to Van Sciver remained below. "No, Y-8, stop, I'll tell you where I am." His next exhalation carried with it a noise he didn't recognize. The cursor blinked. Van Sciver's response finally arrived. Too late. Evan removed his contact lens and fingernails and put them back in the case. He walked out of the vault, through his bedroom, down the hall, and across the condo to the kitchen area. The glass of vodka waited on the island. He picked it up with a trembling hand. He drank it. 5. Common interests are important. For the first time in memory, Evan slept in. Slept wasn't quite right, as he was awake at 5, but he lay in bed until 9, staring at the ceiling, his mind reforming around what he had witnessed, like a starfish digesting prey. At one point he sat up and tried to meditate, but every breath was punctuated not with mindfulness, but a red flare of rage. Finally he went and took a shower. He soaped his right hand and ran it up and down the tile, leaning his weight into the arm to stretch his shoulder. It had been recently injured, and he didn't want the tendons and ligaments to freeze up. Afterward he got dressed. Each bureau drawer held stacks of identical items of clothing. Dark jeans, gray V-necked T-shirts, black sweatshirts. This morning in particular, it was a relief to move on autopilot, to not make any decisions. Clipping a Victorinox watch fob to his belt loop, he padded down the hall into the kitchen. The refrigerator held a jar of cocktail onions, a stick of butter, and 2 vials of Epigen, an anemia med that stimulated the production of red blood cells in the event of a bad bleed. 3 contingency saline bags stared back at him from the meat drawer. His stomach reminded him that he hadn't eaten in almost a day. His brain reminded him to make a sweep of his various safe houses scattered across L.A. County, to take in the mail, change the automated lighting, alter the curtain and blind positions. He had never wanted to leave his condo less. There is nothing you could ever do to make me give up that boy. Behind his front door, he took a deep breath, preparing himself to transition modes. Here at Castle Heights, he was Evan Smoke, importer of industrial cleaning products. Boring by design. He was fit, but not noticeably muscular, neither tall nor short. Just an average guy, not too handsome. The only person who knew that he was not who he seemed was Mia Hall, the single mother in 12B. She had a light scattering of freckles across her nose and a birthmark on her temple that looked like it had been applied by a Renaissance painter. Because all that wasn't complicated enough, she was also a district attorney. When it came to Evan's work, they had settled on an unspoken and uncomfortable policy of don't ask, don't tell. He pressed his forehead to the door, summoning greater resolve. He's the best part of me. He stepped out into the hall, got on the elevator. On the way down, the car stopped and Laura Lee Smithson, 3F, swept in. Evan, it's been a while.
Yes, ma'am.
Always so formal. The third wife to an affluent older gentleman who had recently left her, Laura Lee was a vigorous practitioner of cosmetic surgery and body sculpting. She'd been beautiful once, that much was clear, but it was increasingly unnerving how her forehead remained frozen in an approximation of surprise, no matter what the rest of her features were doing. She was 50 years old, or 70. She wove her arm through Evan's and gave it a girlfriendy shake. There's a craft class right now, scrapbooking. You should really come. Preserve those childhood memories. He looked at her. She had 3 new lines radiating out from her eyes, faint wrinkles in the shiny skin. They looked pretty. They made her face look lived in. Next week they'd be gone. Her face ratcheted even tighter, a tomato about to burst. He contemplated the least number of syllables he could make that would get her to stop talking. He said, "I'm not really a big scrapbooker." She squeezed his arm in hers. "Come on, you have to try new things. At least that's what I'm doing. I'm going through a transition right now, as you might have heard." Evan had heard, but had absolutely no idea how to reply to her. Was this one of those times that people said, "I'm sorry"? Wasn't that a stupid thing to tell someone whose asshole husband had left her? "It'll get easier," sounded equally platitudinous. Fortunately, Laura Lee wasn't much for silences. "I'm getting out there again, you know? Been seeing a new guy, a wedding photographer. But it's hard to tell if he really likes me for me or if he just likes my money." She pursed her inflated lips and gave his arm another little shake. He patted her wrist, using the gesture as subterfuge to disentangle himself from her. But when he did, his hand came away powdery with tan dust. He looked down at her arm and saw the bruise marks she'd tried to conceal. 3 finger-size marks from where someone had grabbed her. She covered her arm with her purse, looked away self-consciously. "He's okay," she said. "You know how those artist types are. Temperamental." Evan had no reply for that. It was none of his business. He thought of Jack walking into space as if stepping off a diving board. Evan needed to get food, and then he had people to kill. Her smile returned, though it labored to reach her cheeks. That's why I'm scrapbooking. They say common interests are